Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugrupul peoples, the Yugambeh, Mananjali, Kombamiri, Noonuk or Quandamooka peoples. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. And my guest today is a man who's written a book on this land management. Professor Bill Gammage will join me soon. His book of, about 2 years ago, The Biggest Estate on Earth. He talks about how the land was managed in a very systematic and scientific way. And this is something, this is new information, even for a lot of us First Nations mob. And there was a mosaic of different kinds of plants and things. There was a pattern to the burning, a mosaic of burn, patchwork sort of burning. So we'll get Bill to tell us why? How come he wrote the book? And we'll go on to throughout and get him to tell us whatever we can draw out of him in the time that we have. Bill Gammage, welcome to the program and thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Oh, not too bad. Thanks for that introduction, Tiger. That's very nice. And, I'm fine.
Very good. That book, it's certainly a massive read, isn't it? It's a big one.
Yes, it'd knock over a bullock, I reckon, but there's a lot to say.
Well, there certainly is, Bill, and it's probably the first of its kind. Correct me if I'm wrong, but has anybody ever gotten down to this sort of detail regarding the land management practices of our mob?
I don't think so, Tiger. I think I would have picked it up. There are people who've got bits of the story, a bit here and a bit there, and they've done very well, and I've pinched their words in the book, but the overall thing, no, I don't think there has been one before this.
What led you to write the book?
Well, I used to work out on farms and that, and I got to know the country around Narandra in the Riverina pretty well. And then I was asked to write a history of Narandra Shire, and that led me to look at the early sources, and there were all these early accounts by the explorers and then the drovers who came afterwards, and they talk about the banks of the Murrumbidgee, where the Narandra is, and they'd say the grass was, up to the horses' bellies and lush grass, and so it was a pastoral paradise. And I knew that the banks of the Murrumbidgee, where they were talking about, is now River Red Gum, very thick River Red Gum forest, and dumped by the various floods. You could see the line of the 1974 flood, the 1956 flood, the 1934 flood going back, and the trees getting bigger and bigger with each layer. So the obvious question for me to ask was, if it was all grass then, how come it's River Red Gum now? Or if you like it the other way, if it's River Red Gum now, how come it was grass then? And you looked at all the possible explanations, and some of them were constant, like salt in the soil, and they'd apply in the early days as well as now, so it couldn't be them. I had a look at bushfire, but as I'm sure most people know, bushfire eucalypts recover very well from fire. They sprout leaves and their trunks and branches, and soon they're back to where they were. So it couldn't have been bushfire to clear all that country and make it such rich grass. And that led me to Chint.
And your information, you obviously done a lot of research for the book. Was there available information around? You had to piece it together? Well, what was it like, the information?
Well, it was quite often a matter of picking up small clues. I mean,
So as a result of your book, are you finding that our people and even settler society mob are taking any leads from the book? Are our mob doing any of this burning?
I don't know that it's actually changed Aboriginal burning practice. That's because I don't know. An Aboriginal woman who thought that a white fella shouldn't be involved in Aboriginal peoples. This is terrific. This will help us prove what we've already always known.
Most certainly. I mean, it certainly opened my eyes because I was fairly ignorant and thinking that, well, this country must have been just scrub, this wild bushland, but that wasn't the case at all, you say.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I grew up assuming that. We all sort of knew one, I think.
So, Bill, what were the reasons that our people did this? Was it purely for sustainability in regards to food, or was it to avoid bushfires like that's happening now? Well, what were the reasons, do you think? And describe to us some of the patterns to the burnings and stuff, and how they had particular burns where there was grass and particular burns where there were trees beside them. Because I think you say it was like the supermarket. We had our own supermarket.
Yeah, I do say that. One place.
So it is a myth then for that projection of our people being aimless wanderers.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that's so. It's an aimless. I mean, they've been here for 50,000 years. The idea that they thought that, to be perfectly honest.
Yes, you would. Well, you do wonder how they ever thought that.
Mm.
Well, in relation to the bushfires today, how do you come to terms with it in your mind that there is still this ignorance, that there's little interest in trying to make some change? It's just, well, let's just wait and see what happens.
Yeah, my impression at the moment.
It is encouraging then when you say that there are firefighters and that those people that deal with these the fires and the deadly results of them, that they're showing some interest making some changes to their ways of doing things. I drove through the Pilliga only just on a fortnight ago, and I see a big patch of that all burnt out. And there's on one side of the road, and on the other side of the road, it's all just waiting. It's a tinderbox just waiting to be lit up. These sorts of areas, it'd be a bit hard to sort of do a patchwork burn there. It's just a sort of a big one fire through the whole lot to try and... Well, I mean, my question, I suppose, is, Bill, where would people start in places like the Pilliga or Big Mob of Country where it's just a tinderbox waiting to go up? Where would one start with trying to do patchwork? I mean, it's almost impossible in that sort of environment, I would think.
Yeah, it's very difficult because for fires later on.
Yes, and there's also the wind factor. You could utilise it if there was a westerly wind, you'd go across to that end of the scrub and start a little way in so the wind would take that fire across to the edge and start off patchwork that way.
Yeah, spot on. That's what you do with rainforest. You burn.
Bill, let me pick up on that point I left off with, Abbott's view on climate change. What are your thoughts on climate change? Is it an issue, or is it something that you just don't bother about, like the federal government appears to be doing, and just take your chances?
Yeah, it's an issue. I'm convinced of that. That it's outside my expertise, but 98%, I think the figure is, of scientists, and not all people on the planet.
That's right.
Yeah, and I'm sure it gets hotter.
Yeah, it's a common sense thing. Well, what you're talking about is really risk management, isn't it? And taking some steps just in case.
Yeah.
Just in case.
It's so much common sense that I really puzzle about, you know, why people argue about whether or not it might happen. It reminds me of the Roman soldiers still on duty in Pompeii when the lava rolled over him. Common sense, I reckon.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And then the other thing that a lot of our people say is, if there's going to be the destruction to the imbalance that's been created within the environment, there's got to be some results. There's got to be some ramifications with all of that, and it might take some quite some time, but I think the signs are there. Torres Strait Island communities where they're saying, you know, the water's coming up higher, and other Pacific Island communities are talking about water levels rising, for example. So that's not just something that's happening out of the blue. That's because the ice country is melting, I would imagine.
Yeah, I lived in Papua New Guinea for a few years, and now there are small islands, not-so-small islands in Bougainville and that, where the salt has now come up into the taro garden. So where they've been growing taro for a long while, it's about.
Yes, there certainly is. Bill, have you got any idea on what are the remnants of the natural flora, the native flora and fauna what have you, that might have been here in 1788 and it's not around now? Is there any? Do you have any idea on the percentage that's left? I believe there's quite a high percentage where it's just gone, lost, extinct.
Yeah, look, I don't have the possible.
Bill, is there a role for media and the schooling system, the education system? I mean, how do we create change? How do we get people to think about some of these issues that, sure, it mightn't affect me and you. I mean, in our lifetime, we haven't got a lot of time, as opposed to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Does the school, the education system and the media, do they have a role to play in this sort of stuff?
I certainly agree with that.
Most certainly. I've got a caller I'm trying to get through. Let's see who we've got. Welcome to Let's Talk. Who we got? Dan, you'll have to try another number. This is the on-air studio. I'm sorry, I can't help you. Try 3892-0100.
Great, thank you very much.
Rightio. Yes, I thought it might be somebody wanting to ask you an intelligent question, Bill, and I got we've got an intelligent question. One of my staff members here. Where do they find him? How do they talk to him? anyway.
Well, that's great that you could help.
yes. Now, you were talking, when I was talking to you earlier before the program, you were saying, you know, you hoped that my people might need to be in policy positions as a result of this book, that our people, there'd be something for us to be proud of and reinforce that which we know. And I think, like you already commented on that, and I think, well, for sure, it certainly reinforced a lot of what we know and brought to people like me new information that strengthens our culture and our beliefs in our old ways.
Yes, I really think that people should pay more heed of Aboriginal expertise, and one way to do that is to have Aboriginal people in leadership roles in managing the environment. So in national parks, in fire services, you could have Aboriginal companies contract managing land for miners and pastoral companies. They could be freer to manage their own country and by that way set an example. I should qualify it a little bit. I don't think there are people here who know as much as the people of 1788. Some knowledge has been lost, even in the north and the centre, where there's still a large degree of traditional community and respect for the law and so on. But the point is, they know more than all non-Aborigines except a few specialist experts in various fields. And more important, many Aboriginal people will stay on country. They'll stay there. Whitefellas, no matter how committed they are, tend to leave, to retire and go home, whereas Aboriginal people stay on country. And that way you can pass on that local expertise. It's got to be local, because how you burn Spinifex is very different from how you manage rainforest, for example. And so they pass on that local expertise, and you gradually accumulate across the generations more and more specialist knowledge. And the way to let that work is to have Aboriginal leadership in parks and fire services and so on, so that that kind of learning and that kind of passing on of knowledge through the schools and the media, as you said earlier, Tiger, is guaranteed to continue. In other words, you've got people who see the importance of the law and continue.
Yes, there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of work to be done. But it's never too late, Bill. We can always make a start and do things differently. I get a bit frustrated by looking around at the not just blackfellow world, but whitefellow world, where there are programs and policies in place that are continuing with the same sort of methods and strategies and things, but not getting any different results, continuing to fail, not getting the outcomes that could be got. So I get a bit frustrated with that. So it's never too late that we can be starting to make a change.
Yeah, I agree. It's frustrating not only about land, but of course my book's about land and law. You know, the respect for all the different species that Australia has. Perhaps that wider thing that you're referring to, which is respect for lifestyles and so on, should underwrite what I'm talking about. But it is very difficult because people who've put their lives into one policy and are now senior managers and so on might find it very difficult to change around. I recognise that. But here's one simple reason why it's worthwhile doing. As I said, every summer, some capital city has its margins burnt and people killed. That's a national shame. That should never happen. And that simple fact means that we are not doing things properly now. And so it should be a big push for leadership.
Well, Bill, on that note, I certainly agree wholeheartedly on that note. We'll wind her up unless you've got anything else to add to that.
Well, I'd emphasise the importance of local management. As I said, Spinifex is different from rainforest. And I'd like to thank you, Tiger, for talking about issues like this. They're really important, not only for Aboriginal people, but for our country as a whole. So thank you very much.
No, thank you, mate. It's really good to get you online and get this much of your time. I really appreciate it. And I hope to catch up with you one day.
Yeah, next time you're in Canberra, go straight past the Pilliga and come here and we're going to have a yarn.
All right, mate. Listen, you have a great day and thanks a lot again, Bill. Thank you.
No worries. See you, Tiger.
Bye, mate. See ya. Professor Bill Gammage joining me from Canberra. And you must get that book. Sure, it is big enough to knock over a bullock, like he said. It's a big, thick book. It's a couple of inches thick. And it's called The Biggest Estate on Earth. And it'll give you a different picture. It'll give you a new understanding, I would expect. Broaden your understanding in regards to how our mob manage this country. And it's not all that long ago, is it? Just a bit over 200 years, 230 years or something. A bit over a couple of hundred years. Our people managed this country. We had our own systems in place. Our women and children walked free of fear. We had international trade arrangements with people like Macassans and people. The Dutch, Portuguese, there was trade arrangements made with those people pulled in on the West Coast back long before the British ever got here, long before. And our different clan groups managed their own estates. And they had the arrangements and relationships, agreements with each neighbouring clan group. And they were all responsible for their own estate. I've got Roscoe on the line. Roscoe, you like the discussion there with Bill Gammage?
Yeah, he was spot on, mate. He was right on the money. And I was just about to ring up and suggest what he just suggested anyway.
All right.
He should get more Aboriginal guys out there to do the work and show the people how to do it.
Makes sense, eh?
Oh, it does. It's just ridiculous going out there. It's like, you know, sending a plumber out to do be an electrician. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah. You were saying you lived up there in Arnhem Land for a while, did you?
Yeah, I lived out at Owenpelly and Goombalanya there.
All right. You would have seen a bit of the burning and that happen?
Oh, heaps of it. Always driving in and out, watching them burn off, and not only in Arnhem Land, but right through Kakadu and everywhere. So.
All right.
You still do it, which is good because they're maintaining the land and they're looking after the regrowth, the whole lot of it. So it's the easiest way to do it instead of getting a whippersnapper and a tractor out.
Well, we just need the authorities, the governments, and that to sort of wake up and pull in the experts and give them a job, pay them to do it, and then
Why not? I agree with you. Yeah, it's good to see some bloke finally get on the radio. It can talk some sense, as far as, you know, like a white fellow, you know, it is.
Yeah, yep.
Most of them talk a lot of dribble, then you've got to cop it. So anyway.
Yes, he's certainly a man of quite knowledgeable and makes a lot of sense, he does.
I'd like to get a hold of that book and have a read anyway.
Yeah, it's a big one. The library might have it, but she is a big one. The greatest estate on earth, mate. She's a beauty.
The biggest
estate on earth, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Professor Bill Gammage. All right, Roscoe, thanks for your call, buddy.
Thank you.
You have a good day. Bye now. Yes, that's how can you argue? How can you argue with the views of Bill Gammage, well documented, well researched, but the fact that First Nations people do have the ancient knowledge. We manage this country since the first sun rose and shone. And that's all been turned upside down by the invasion of the coloniser only just over 200 years ago. And you don't have to feel shame or defensive about that. It's a fact. And we did live in harmony. We lived in balance with the environment. And I continue to say, my people are the supreme conservationists, the supreme environmentalists. Our people knew their business, and there's a lot of that knowledge still around. A lot lost, but there's a lot of that knowledge still around, and it's time to engage with the experts in the First Nations communities. Time for me to go. I'm back tomorrow. Make sure you join me for Let's Talk on your First Nations station.